Thou who standest beyond both the darkness and the light, who art hidden by the names we give thee, who movest in mystery to touch us to life, grant us in this hour the glory and power of thy presence. Break through the safe customs of our praise, turn back the thin devices of our devious fear, and let us hear thy word reverberate in the high places of our hearts and in the deep abysses of our need. If our good works have protected us from thy mercy, or our prayers camouflaged our rebellion and sin, or our faith made thy grace futile, or ease blinded us to a vast world of need, then, O God, put us straight, undeceive us, and bring us where we will find that thou art our Savior and our Lord, and in doing thy will, find rest. Amen. Before I introduce our speaker, may I point out that tomorrow at noon, at 12 o'clock, there will be a Dutch treat luncheon. I emphasize the word Dutch treat so you won't be surprised, in the cafeteria, so that you may have an opportunity to dialogue with our speaker about his lectures. He will have, of course, completed two by the time you are able to meet with him. But I encourage you to be in the cafeteria tomorrow at noon if you are free from classes at that time. Ten years ago, the speaker for the Adams Lectures and I made the decision to team teach a course on the family here at Southeastern Seminary. That decision resulted in one of the most significant and enriching experiences of my life, for it put me in the closest of working relationships with a colleague who had, in fact, been a friend from our seminary days together in Louisville, Kentucky. And it gave me the opportunity to work with and learn from what I believe to be one of the most creative minds working today in the field of theology and pastoral care. It was in the research for that class and his own struggle for self-understanding that our speaker, Richard L. Hester, gave birth to the subject matter for the Adams Lectures of this week. Ted Adams, for whom these lectures are named, and with whom many of us had the privilege of serving on this very campus, would no doubt be very proud of our lecturer and the content of his lectures. Ted valued faith that had a practical application. He valued critical and creative thinking, and he valued integrity of life and mind. Dick Hester is the embodiment of the values for which Ted Adams and this institution have stood. Since coming to this faculty 15 years ago, Dick Hester has been a compassionate, wise, and insightful counselor for hundreds of students. He has been an innovative teacher, asking his students to learn the skills of pastoral care by first being honest with themselves, and by modeling that honesty for them, I might add. He has been a tower of strength, the embodiment of integrity, and an articulate spokesperson for the faculty when the winds of controversy threaten to uproot us. And has been my friend. We all shall miss Dick as he leaves us at the end of this semester and takes his considerable skills to another place. I think that what C.F.D. Moule said of Professor F.F. Bruce nicely sums up also Dick Hester's character and life among us. To think of Dick Hester is to be assured that the psalmist's vision can come true. Mercy and truth are met together. Righteousness and peace have kissed each other. I know of no better example of uncompromising truthfulness wedded to that most excellent gift of charity. We are fortunate that such a man has been among us and that he has come to share the rich fruits of his insight with us in this, the first of his series of lectures on the family and the making of theology. His first lecture today is Hands That Rock the Cradle. Dick, we welcome you.
Thank you, Furman. I really hate to speak now and shatter the picture that has been painted by the person who's introduced me of myself. I want to thank you, Furman, for that generous introduction. And I want to welcome you here to this lectureship. I want to say a word myself about Ted Adams. He was here on this faculty when I arrived in 1975, and for 5 years I enjoyed his friendship. I valued his counsel and his serene perspective. Often I would go out of a faculty meeting in great distress to talk with Ted and have him put things in clearer and better perspective. As I got to know him, I discovered that he was a central person in introducing modern pastoral care to ministers in the South. Ted Adams in 1930 made contact with a scientifically based understanding of pastoral care and counseling and brought this understanding with him 6 years later to Richmond when he became pastor of First Baptist Church. In 1930, he went to a workshop led by Otis Rice, chaplain at St. Luke's Hospital in Chicago. And as Ted told me, on that occasion, Otis Rice lectured about the new concept in pastoral counseling, and as Ted put it, for the first time in my life, I learned it was more important to listen than to talk. And it was a very revealing experience. This became the first significant contact between modern pastoral care and Southern Baptist ministers. Beginning his first year, 1936, in Richmond, he established a series of presentations on family life, which became an annual affair, and distinguished himself as the first minister ever to use the word sex in the pulpit of the First Baptist Church of Richmond, Virginia. Oh, thank you, that's much better. In 1948, after several years of contact with Wayne Oates at Southern Baptist Seminary, Ted established a church staff position in pastoral counseling, the first in the South. I'm delighted to be able to give these lectures named to honor the memory of Ted Adams, a man who was a distinguished early pioneer in pastoral care and counseling. I am also anxious about this assignment. I have suffered the usual misgivings about it. Will anybody come to hear me? Will what I say make any sense to them? Will people be bored? will they be put off by the first lecture so that they won't come and hear the other two? All symptoms of over-investing in the importance of this enterprise. And as I was going through this familiar litany of anxiety, I recalled an encounter with my daughter that helped me put things back in perspective. She was about 4 and her brother was about 6 when this took place. It had been raining for about a week in the spring in Enid, Oklahoma, and my wife, Beverly, had been shut up in the house with these two children and their friends during this week-long period. I was away teaching, doing the Lord's work, and uninvolved in the rising epidemic of cabin fever that was going on in our house. And one day I came home for lunch, during which time my wife said to me, "Guess what the kids did today?" I could not guess. I let them paint the storm cellar. In Enid, Oklahoma, everybody has a storm cellar. I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, I got together a bunch of the old paint out of the garage, and they and their friends and helped them take that paint downstairs, and they painted the storm cellar. They had a great time, and the kids were pitching in with excitement, telling what all they had done." And my response was not an excited one. It was to say, I don't know whether that was such a good idea. And this was followed by a rather chilly silence. After which my daughter, whose eyes were about table level, looked across the table at me and said, "Daddy, it's not the end of your life." Well, these lectures are not the end of my life. They are not the be-all and end-all of anything. As a matter of fact, they are no more than my attempt to tell you how I am trying to figure out the relationship between our families, mainly my family, and our theology, mainly my theology. And so here goes. A shattering bolt of lightning struck near our house at 1 o'clock in the morning. In seconds, our 2 and 4-year-old children were in bed clinging to us. In their fear of the sudden Oklahoma thunderstorm, they fled to the source of power and protection they knew, the visible, tangible gods who were their parents. They had heard about an unseen God from us and from teachers at church. They had prayed to this God at meals and at bedtime. They had asked, what did this unseen God do, and what did this unseen God not do? But when lightning struck, the only gods that had any cash value for them were the two fallible human beings in the bed down the hall. We lived in Oklahoma during our children's most formative years. The spring and fall weather was a frequent threat. Tornado warnings, hail the size of softballs that pounded the roof off of the house, a flood that filled the storm cellar from which we had exited moments before. Although my wife and I had bouts of anxiety over these invasions of nature, our children regarded them as exciting adventures. So long as they had us, their gods, relatively intact, they were okay. How is it that children put their parents in the position of a deity? And how do they move from a view that their parents are gods to an adult grasp of a God who is beyond these family deities? Theologians don't often linger over such questions. They typically do their work upon a complex body of doctrine that has evolved over centuries. Rather than ask how our personal view of God develops, the theologian attempts to answer such questions as, what view of God is most faithful to the church's historic witness to God's revelation? And how does this view of God speak to the present human predicament? The question of how we come to acquire a notion of God in the first place occupies a subterranean region beneath the usual landscape of theology. And in order to answer it, we must move backward in time, not as the theologian does, toward moments in history marked as events of revelation, but rather backward in human development toward childhood and infancy. The answer to our question today lies not in historic events such as Abraham's departure from Ur or Israel's exodus from Egypt or the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth, but rather in intimate family events such as the quality of the infant's care and feeding by parents or parent figures. Early in this century, Sigmund Freud began exploring how one develops a view of God. In the course of his work with psychoanalytic patients, he discovered that a person's view of the deity bore a distinctly parental stamp. From birth, he said, children direct toward parents instinctual drives of sex and aggression. Now, Freud operated true to the paternalistic culture of 19th century Vienna, and he worked out his theory based on the male child. The boy of 4 to 6 years, said Freud, enters into an Oedipal period in which he begins to have sexual desires for his mother. These desires and the events that follow them are unconscious, and they come to light only in the process of psychoanalysis. The boy is afraid to fulfill his sexual wishes because of his father's power to castrate him for his rivalry. And he resolves this desire-fear conflict by identifying with the father and internalizing the father's demands and values. This internalization becomes the core of the child's superego, the conscience. Later, this internalized father that speaks now from within becomes projected out onto the universe as a cosmic parent whose love and prohibitions become the care and the demand of the deity. That's Freud's view, in a nutshell, I might say. His view has been challenged on several fronts, too numerous to mention. After examining a number of cases of adults who were sexually abused as children, Alice Miller, a Swiss psychoanalyst, has questioned Freud's drive theory. She contends that the sexual and aggressive drives that Freud attributed to children are actually the sexual and aggressive drives of the adult. Adults, she says, project onto the child their wish for the child to meet their own needs. Since wanting a child to meet the adult's sexual needs or wanting to use a child as a target for aggression is not acceptable for the adult to admit, the adult handles the situation by making the child responsible. She points out that Freud's earliest paper on hysteria held that all of the 18 patients Freud studied in this particular report had been the object of sexual abuse by adults. But a year later, Freud formulated his drive theory, which shifted the sexual aggression from the adult to the child. Now, I don't want to belabor Freud's theory, but I do want to say this about it. Although his view of the child's early development of a conception of God leaves much room for revision, we need to give him credit for pointing theology in a new direction. He introduced the idea that God's revelation, in an historical sense, is always preceded by a prior revelation that comes in infancy and childhood. and in the intimacy of family relationships. He also introduced the troublesome thought that this earliest revelation occurs at an unconscious level. If we accord Freud's view credibility, we are left with a split-level understanding of theology. One level is conscious and rational. The other level is unconscious and non-rational. And the most decisive of the two, the one exerting the most influence upon thought and behavior, is the unconscious, non-rational one. Freud's view has not gone unnoticed by theologians, and some of them have followed him into this primal level of theological belief. One of these theologians is Gordon Kaufman. According to Kaufman, the word revelation has two basic meanings. It can be applied in a general sense to a wide range of human experience, or it can be used in a particular sense to mean the extra human agency of God. In its general sense, revelation refers to deeply held beliefs that are not based on reason. At this level of revelation, says Kaufman, what we believe does not come to us like other realities because every thought we have already assumes these beliefs. What has come to us through this general form of revelation is an object of faith that we get through our history of becoming a self. We absorb this revelation at a primal level outside our conscious awareness. And these beliefs form the foundation of our worldview. Both the self and its experience, says Kaufman, are shaped by the cultural system of meanings which we take in with our mother's milk. Examples of such unconscious beliefs would be that the world is basically a friendly place or an unfriendly one. That the opposite sex can or cannot be trusted. That God cares about me or God doesn't. Such beliefs are not rationally developed. They are unconsciously absorbed in the family. My thesis is this, that the family is the earliest source of revelation to the child. Through the particularity of family relationships, the child first begins to form a personal conception of the way the world is, including who God is and how God relates to humankind in general and to him or her in particular. These unconscious family-shaped beliefs determine how we respond to later encounters with historical faith traditions. An ongoing theological task, therefore, is coming to recognize our primal unconscious beliefs and to reconcile them with beliefs more rationally acquired in a faith tradition. For Christians, this task of sifting through beliefs acquired in the family requires a careful exploration of the life and teaching of Jesus of Nazareth. And of particular relevance is what the gospel writers tell us about Jesus' view of the family, Jesus' relationship to his own family, and his response to the religious and cultural traditions about the family. In these lectures, using Jesus as a reference point, I shall explore how we may uncover the primal theologies we've acquired from our families, learn how those theologies both help and hinder our response to the God who is beyond our family gods, and see beyond our family gods to the God revealed by Jesus. But in order to develop this thesis, I first must set forth in more detail my understanding of how we develop our earliest view of God in the setting of our family. The British pediatrician and psychoanalyst, Donald W. Winnicott, provides my point of departure. Winnicott assumes that the baby is born with inherited tendencies that lead the individual in the direction of growth. This process can be counted on to move in a positive direction, says Winnicott, toward the integration of personality, wholeness of body and mind, and healthy relationships with other people. The positive movement, though, depends on a facilitating environment, mainly what he calls a good enough mother. To move beyond a sexist statement, a good enough parent who is able to tune in to the infant's natural tendencies toward wholeness and support them. The good enough mother is the child's first encounter with a deity. We might ask, well, what about a not good enough mother? What about a bad one? Or a bad parent? Or bad parents? Or a terribly bad family situation? Nonetheless, it is still true. That's the child's first encounter with the deity, for good or ill. According to Winnicott, in the earliest stage of life, the infant is completely merged with his environment in a condition of what he calls primary narcissism. That's a state in which the infant knows nothing except himself, his needs, and what will meet his needs. Gradually, he begins to be able to distinguish between himself and the external world. But on the way to this self-other differentiation, he passes through an important intermediate state. And that's what we want to pay some attention to. What about this intermediate state? Winnicott says, between the mother, who is physically holding the baby, and the baby, there is a layer which we have to acknowledge as an aspect of herself and at the same time an aspect of the infant. A similar condition exists when the baby is in the mother's womb. Mother and child are one, but at the same time they are separate. Between them are tissues of the third nature, where the endometrium of the mother intermingles with the placenta of the baby. When the baby is born, the physical intermediate state is lost, and a psychological intermediate state replaces it. This intermediate state is the space in which imagination, creativity, and faith come to life as the child plays with the difference between his internal subjective world and the external world of actuality. In this intermediate space, the infant uses illusions to deal with the real world, with the external world. Between him and the external world, the boundaries are soft and permeable. In fact, for the small infant, they are so permeable that he imagines himself to be the creator of whatever caring person comes to feed and hold and change and take care of him. That we might call primal omnipotence. As this occurs, says Winnicott, it's important that the parent support the infant's illusions, including the illusion that he has created her for his exclusive use. Anyone here who has had the experience of caring for a small infant knows the complete and total demands of this infant and what is required of a parent to meet those demands, to respond to those demands, to be with this child as the child demands it. And Winnicott says doing that, responding that way, is being a good enough parent. It's not a perfect task. That's why good enough. The good enough mother helps the infant create a world of his own making. Her ability to give herself to her child in tune with his impulses becomes a foundation for the child's moving on later to a more reality-based way of relating to objects in the world. The illusion first must occur for him later to experience the disillusion of not being able to have the